Thank you, David, and thank you everyone for the opportunity to be here. What I'm going to talk about is the science, as David's pointed out, impossible to do this in 10 minutes very well. So I'll go through a lot of material. Some of the slides I won't dwell on too much, but to try to introduce to you some of the concepts that we may be able to pick up in the discussions as we go forward. I'll talk about what we've observed to be happening, what we anticipate will happen, make the linkage to energy futures, because this is an issue about energy futures, and talk then more about managing risk in the context of the fact that, as David's pointed out, we don't know everything, we will never know everything. That is not new to people in business. It is actually a bit hard for some governments to handle. It's just simply a matter of how we actually manage that risk. And I'll spend a bit of time talking about that. These are some of the things that we now know. We know that the planet over the last century has warmed by about 0.7 degrees. We know that we've had a particularly warm decade, the last decade, that snow cover is decreased across the Northern Hemisphere in most regions, and especially in spring and summer, and that's already having influences on available water in some areas. We know that the summer period averaged over the whole of the Northern Hemisphere and for the last century has increased by 12 days. Actually, in parts of the northern parts of Eurasia and the Americas, the summer is now 1.5 months longer. This is not something for the future. This is happening now. People are responding to it, and biological systems are responding to it now. The Arctic sea ice has decreased around 3% on average per decade. The last century, last decade, it decreased by 10%, and I'll come back to this in a moment. Sea levels associated with the general warming, mainly due to simply the thermal expansion of water, not melting of ice caps and dramatic things like that, has risen by around about 2 millimetres per year, average over the last 45 years. And as carbon dioxide has been taken up by the oceans, which is fortunate that it has, otherwise things would be happening faster, it's acidified the surface of the ocean. So averaged over the whole of the Earth, the oceans are now a tenth of a pH unit more acidic than they were. So key findings are that the key gases, carbon dioxide, nitrous oxide and methane, the concentrations are at levels that we know quite confidently exceed anything for the last 650,000 years, and for something like carbon dioxide, probably the last 20 million years. The increases we know, this is the kind of work that I did when I was an active scientist 20, 25 years ago, to study the global budgets of these things to try to work out why they were changing. It's not a dogma, it's not an ideology, it's an attempt to understand from physical principles why these things are changing. We know carbon dioxide is changing primarily because of the combustion of fuels. The other gases are changing primarily because of land use changes and agriculture. The key findings then that I've listed out of all of the new publications is that the warming is unequivocal. It's clear in the temperatures in the atmosphere, in the oceans. It's clear in the responses, mainly sea level rise due to thermal expansion and to deglaciation. It's very likely, greater than 90%, that this is due to these gases, that it's not natural. I simply pick this point up because we still will get, and we will continue to get, newspaper articles where someone somewhere has said, well, the Earth's always had a varying climate and it'll continue to do. Yes, absolutely right, but the last 25 years the science community has been spending its time trying to find out why this change is taking place. And this is the result. We're 90% sure this is due to these gases. And the third point down the bottom is similar. And that is where it's very unlikely, less than 5%, that this is a natural variability, and it's even less likely that it's due to variations in solar output, despite the fact that we had, as recent as only about a month and a half ago, senior ministers of our government saying that that's what they thought it was. This is what has been summarised in terms of looking at the situation for Australia in a few minutes that I've got. One is that we're anticipating rainfall. The colours, everything from yellow out to red, is the loss of rainfall. This is by 2030, based on 23 international models, groups around the world that are trying to estimate. We lose rainfall in all of these estimates virtually across the whole of the country, a little bit of ambiguity at the very northern part of the country. But when you add that to the fact, that when we calculate the evaporation because of the warmer temperatures, and here the colours yellow through red are increases evaporation, then the consequences of these two things together are that we're anticipating loss of available water everywhere across the Australian continent. For us, and that is one of, they are the perhaps the key findings. But there are many others, and I'm not going to go through these in detail. You can scan your eyes down this because the science is now trying to unfold this into the kind of detail that many of you might want to know in terms of looking at your own exposure, if you're dependent on climate variability in these various ways. And many companies that I deal with today are doing exactly that. The snow industry, for example, for 15 years have been taking this seriously. Not that they believe me, absolutely, but simply they know there's a risk, they've got to manage it. These are other areas that have been looked at. Wind, fire risk, sea level, acidification, severe weather and so on. A lot of information now available about the expectations of these changes into the future. And as David's pointed out, yes, uncertainties associated with the modelling and uncertainties about what we're going to do. Global community is going to do about the level of emissions. Just to pick one sector, just to give you an example of how complicated it is when you then start to delve down and say, well, what does that mean to me? If you think about agriculture, well, there's a change of productive capacity with trade-offs that you can already see starting to happen now, with governments determining, well, actually, we're going to have more water for Melbourne. We're going to trade that off, or someone else thinking we need more water for the red gums. These trade-offs are happening now. This will be more of an issue as we go forward. Available, the changes to available natural systems and the ecosystems that they produce. The threat to infrastructure, because we're anticipating a more stormy environment than we had before, despite the loss of rainfall. The fact that we're not embedded in this as an island. What happens to agriculture here is influenced by the price of products elsewhere and the capacity of people to do agriculture elsewhere. So how are we thinking about that in our own case, our exposure? And finally, a revolutionary change, the kind of things that David's talked about with regard to energy futures. So what about energy futures? Just three points I want to make very quickly. The first is that without mitigation, that was without intervening in this situation, the concentrations of these gases will continue to go up and so will the temperature. It's simple, but in fact there are people in the community who don't understand that it's a physical reality we can't get away from. We can't manage our way out of that reality. And it has to do with the fact, in the case of carbon dioxide, that the oceans can only move 2,000 million tonnes from the upper ocean into the depths of the deep ocean, effectively out of circulation, per year. And we're currently putting about 9,000 million tonnes in. So when people talk about an 80% reduction, it, and in many cases they don't understand this, all they're talking about is physical reality. That's how quickly the Earth system can actually take up this gas. That's where we've got to get to at some point. Otherwise, the planet continues to warm. The second point is the positive thing is, and that is that many of us, and it'll be in your businesses, in your homes, in buildings like this, the use of energy is fairly poor. So there are real opportunities almost immediately with payback periods of 1, 2, 5 years to invest in changes that actually lower your energy use, save your money, and contribute to this issue. We have to move as a community quickly down that track. The third point is, David mentioned, people are modelling the balances between doing something and not doing something, and that will continue, and it is early days with those models. I've been involved in building one of these models myself with a team of 13 people, but at the end of the day, most of these models at the moment are suggesting that the evolution of the energy system to a much lower level of emissions is going to cost only something about 0.1% or less per annum in GDP. That will have to be weighed up against the cost of letting it happen. And I don't have time to go into that. The other point that I wanted to reiterate that David raised is that when you actually look at what the options present, you find it's complicated. And it's complicated because you never really know what the cost of any of the technologies will be. You might know what it costs to build a power plant, nuclear power plant today, but what will it cost into the future? What will be the cost of emitting carbon as you go forward into the future? How will new technologies change those costs as we go forward and we invest in the research and so on? These are uncertainties. That's the real world. Secondly, the capacity to deliver either the power you need, the energy you need, or the reductions you need on time. Every particular technology has a different capacity. The fourth one is it acceptable? We do live in a democracy, and therefore some people don't like some of these alternatives. We have to live with that. We have to plan around it. At the very least, we have to try to take people with us in these things. So there are issues that have to be in this portfolio of considerations is what I would recommend, rather than people putting up their hands and saying, let's go nuclear, let's go solar, let's go geothermal or whatever. It isn't a sensible way, it's not a 21st century way of looking at these things. So let us look then at managing risk. This is the statement that came out after the Intergovernmental Panel Synthesis Report came out a few weeks ago from the Secretary General of the UN. And he's saying the scientists have said this, now it's up to the policymakers to follow. Well, I wish I shared his confidence, particularly at the UN level. I think, like David does and many others, it's going to be some time for the organisation like the UN to get their head around this. So I just make a couple of final points about risk management. Some of these will be very clear to people in business. And that is that there is a time component in risk. And for climate change, we don't know which of these coloured lines we're going up, whether it's a linear a change or it's something that will start to get worse as we approach, say, 2 degrees, or there'll be a step change, the catastrophic or the non-linear change. And I'll come back to some of the possibilities there. But you have to manage risk around the fact that we're not sure about how these things are going to unfold. The second thing is that any risk is not like a scientific probability. It's a balance between the probability, the blue areas, of something happening and the magnitude if it happens. And it could be any of these fractions. I've just shown a suite of three different areas there where, one, it's because the risk is so high because of the probability being high, and the other one, it's the risk is so high because if it happens, it's a disaster. We have to manage that kind of thing. And those are the kinds of things that I will then talk very briefly about in the last couple of slides. This slide actually came out with the synthesis report. It simply shows six futures in which they've tried to identify the concentrations at which we would need to plateau, whether it be just CO2 or CO2 combined with other gases, and the temperature we would get, the change in temperature, and the change in sea level. And I only want to make one point, and that is that the European Union target at the moment for what they believe is the maximum change we should have before it becomes dangerous is 2 degrees. And you see, only one of these scenarios gets you there, and it's the one that is around about the 450 parts per million combined effect of all of the gases. But what it tells you is that we have to, therefore, peak our emissions in order to get to that target sometime between the year 2000 and 2015. This is a very, very important message that's coming from the scientific community. We don't have time to fiddle. We don't have time for the UN to get their act together. We have to work in a concerted way to stabilise. Otherwise, we're going to exceed 2 degrees. Many scientists think that's already too much, but that is the European position at the moment. There are risks associated with us here in Australia, associated with how the UN or anybody will deal with the inequities that exist. Everyone's exposed to this differently. Everyone has different capacity to respond to it. Everyone's a different stage of development. This slide, I just realised I drew in 1995, and it got an enormously negative reaction, particularly from your community. And it's because it's very simplistic, I know, but it simply says that if we actually attempted to go through 100 years to equity, then we would have to share these emissions very differently than we are at the moment. And it simply says that, therefore, for OECD countries, we are very close to where we have to peak our emissions and then start coming down. It's the same message that came out of the previous slide. There are risks because of the discontinuity. That is, if things change more rapidly than we thought. This is a picture of sea ice cover around the Arctic, and the red line is what happened last year. Now, do you think we're not worried about that? Of course, the scientific community is worried about that, that that isn't a curve that goes like that. We simply don't have enough physical understanding of the system to know. So those kinds of risks exist, and whether it be a country designing its protocol or a company, then you need to realise that things could change more quickly than you might anticipate in the year 2007. These are estimates that were made by the IPCC in 2001 as to what would happen. That is the coloured and dotted lines going into the future. The red lines is what actually happened. We underestimated, the scientific community underestimated what would happen to temperature and sea level. This is actually very new results indicating the capacity of the oceans to soak up this. We've always thought, since I was researching this area, that this capacity would go down in time for a number of physical and chemical reasons. Well, unfortunately, we've now observational evidence it's already going down. It's been going down for the last couple of decades. That hasn't been built into any of these future plans. This is a picture of what we've done in terms of emissions, black dots. And the red line is a future in which we hold on to economic development and the kind of energy underpinning of that we've had through the first half of this century. The blue and green lines are stabilisation lines. That is what we would have to do to stabilise the temperature at different levels. And it just simply is pointing out to you that in 2006, global emissions were bigger than they were ever been, despite all the rhetoric and the political posturing and so on. We're on the red line, and we're nowhere near a stabilisation line. Now, whether we will stay on that will depend on a whole pile of things. What science comes out next year with, and you have to actually manage the risk and uncertainties associated with that. So, in conclusion, the science strongly reinforces the views that global warming is occurring. The changes are large, even on geological timescales. I haven't stressed this, but it is important for people to realise that a 1 or 2 degree change is big. It's not like the change that takes place when you go outside the building or from night to day. This is a globally average change. 1 degree is large. The changes are large even on those states. The responses are urgent because of the long lifetime of these gases. Once you put them there, they stay there for hundreds of years. Australia, particularly south of 30 degrees, is likely to experience a drier climate. We're really challenged by this, all of us, for a whole pile of reasons. It's complex, the science is complex, but the responses are complex. We need integrated responses. We don't want people, particularly with very sectoral views of the world, putting forward their idea to how to solve this problem. It's not that simple. We want integrated responses. We want to avoid self-interest dominating what we try to do, particularly as a community, and we have to do that in a way that balances aspirations. We all have different aspirations, and their multiplicity, multiple, they're not just about being wealthier next year. There's a spectrum of uncertainty. We do not know everything, and that will always remain the case. There's the probabilities and risks. The probabilities that I talk about as a scientist are not the same probability that you use in a risk management. And you have to weigh those things yourself. You have to make your own risk assessments. And the potential seriousness of it, I think, has just been totally underestimated. And that really means that I think the urgency is there. Now, if you don't believe that today, my view is that you're taking a risk, because it might be next year that you believe it, or it might be in 10 years' time, but I think it'll come. Thank you.